All right, good morning. We're back live on Fuel for Thought. I'm Eli Kogan. I'm here with my co-host, Sam Birnbaum. And today we've got Greg Stanley from Arms Sotheby's with us. Greg brings over 25 years of analytical and numbers experience, applies it to cars, and is the car consultant for RM and also does their podcast. Today we're lucky to have him on the show in person, and we're going to be going over a little bit about the results of yesterday's auction here at Auto Car Club, as well as a little bit about the market trends and what we like and don't like in the car world. Welcome, sure. Greg.
Hey, thanks so much for having me here. I appreciate it.
Of course.
Yeah, it's bright and early the day after a good sale, a long week ahead of it. We pulled that auction together pretty quickly.
Yeah, this was an amazing venue to have the auction. Amazing results. As you mentioned, I host the Collector Car Podcast, which is the official podcast of RM Sotheby's. Just a quick little plug for some of the stuff we have coming up. I think your listeners might find interesting.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I do some fun stuff, interview some experts, collectors. I go over a lot of market trends. I just did Shelby market trends this last week, dug deep into the numbers. Some fun stuff we have coming up, launching Collector Car Fantasy Football on Tuesday. Going to have, if you're a fantasy football person, instead of picking 11 players in, you know, 11 different positions and having a bench and building your team,
right,
we're going to pick 11 cars from 11 categories to build a collection. So it should be a lot of fun. I'll have four experts, including myself.
Sounds like a blast.
Yeah, we're going to do it live streaming Tuesday night. Just go to Collector Car Podcast.
Now, how are people picking the cars? Is this purely on a speculative kind of role here? Like, all right, what do we think is going to go up and down? Or is this pick your favorites and let's see where they go? And
or do you provide a roster?
So basically, they have to, I'll have all the information out there. They'll have to go to evaluation tool.
Right.
And they'll have to pick 11 cars in 11 categories that do not exceed $1 million.
Ah.
So that's the salary cap.
Yep,
got it.
And then once the valuation tool is updated,
all the good cars are under that anyway.
Right, right. Makes it difficult. I have an under $30,000 bucket that you have to pick a car you think is going
right
to appreciate.
All right.
I also have a Kardashian bucket. So that's, how do you find Kardashian cars? Luxury? Is it a Rolls Royce? Is it a Bentley? Is it a McLaren SLR?
Speaking of Rolls Royce, to interrupt and go off on a quick tangent. Holy shit, that Rolls Royce yesterday.
That thing went nuts.
That was what, estimate crazy, like 225 ish.
Yeah, I got a catalog right over here.
I got it right in front of me. And we actually had an auto member who wanted to bid on that. And I could not believe where it sold. Estimate was 200 to 250. And it went for over 300.
Went for 405.
405. 405 out on
a 200. It's a really, really nice car, too.
Yeah, but that's insane.
Yeah, and I'll get into that a little bit
In
the numbers here in a second.
We want to get into the numbers. I mean,
from a pure
emotional reaction standpoint,
it's,
I mean, the car was
174.
Was a really nice, really, really nice driver quality is what I would call it. I wouldn't peg it as the a number one example, but wow, that just blew past the estimate. We had a lot of things go past estimate yesterday.
Right, and that's a lot of the stuff I cover is, you know, what exceeded expectations, what looks like a future market trend, what is declining, what is soft.
Right.
And that's what's fun about the Collector Car Fantasy Football is because the goal is you want to pick the cars you think are going to appreciate in the next 3, 6, 9 months.
Right. Right.
And so we're going to kick it off. We're going to have another round. Whenever the evaluation tool is updated, we'll have another round. And then we'll have the Super Bowl in January. So if listeners want to participate, just go to collectorcarpodcast.com. I'll have a form there where you can fill out. You can actually send it to me, and you have to name your team, your quote-unquote team, your collection.
Are there prizes?
Great question. You know what? The Super Bowl's a year from now, so yes, I'll say there will be prizes.
Nice.
If I get enough folks, we'll have brackets.
You get to take home your number one pick if you win.
Let's not go that far. So that's really nice. Cool. And then also, I do a series I call The Ultimate Garage. So I'm going to have Wayne Carini on in a couple weeks.
Nice.
Awesome.
And he's going to pick his Ultimate Garage. If you're a Porsche fan and you like listening to Spike Ferriston's podcast, he was on a couple weeks ago. And so he had to
pick his... Spike, pay us for your plug.
Right. Right. Yeah. And so you have to pick 10 spots in your Ultimate Garage.
Right.
And so...
I bet I could guess what Spike picked.
Well, you know what? He kind
of
took it as a 10 best Porsches of all time.
Of course
that wasn't my intent. You know, it could be the car you drove in high school.
There's other cars out there, Spike.
There's other cars out there. Exactly. So it's fun because you can see into the mind of experts, and there could be a car like the president of RM Sotheby's, Kenneth Ahn. He has I don't even remember.
What does he drive?
He's got like a 1983 Mercedes.
Yeah, I read actually the story about it on the website. It was pretty cool. And I'm going to butcher the story probably. And
me
you,
too.
I'm sure you know it better, but basically.
And pull it up.
When he was growing up, there was a specific Mercedes that his dad used to say was like the pinnacle of success. Like that's the car you get when you've made it.
It was like an S-Class or something maybe?
Yeah, it's somewhere on the
it
website.
It wasn't that special. It was like an E, I think. It's like an E320 or something.
I got to pull this up so I don't butcher it. Let's see.
Like here. What Carmelo Soprano drove?
Yeah, basically it was probably worth about $4,000. You know, it's probably worth about $4,000 today. But he had such strong memories tied to that car.
Right.
That when it was sold, he just, his father
had passed and the car sold. And he went back to the guy who had the car.
Oh, here it is.
Yeah. And he
missed an E320.
Yeah. And he missed the chance, I think, to get
W124.
The car, if I remember correctly. And then years later, the car popped up in some sort of serendipitous timing where he happened to be in town on a connecting flight, went to go get the car and brought it home, and that's kind of the most special car to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think both on the market trend side of things, but also on the collectability and emotional collecting side, I have these funny theories we always like to talk about on the podcast. Like one of them is totally applicable to today's or yesterday's auction, which is cars reach their peak and also their valleys when the generation that grew up looking at those cars on a poster can afford them or ages out. And we saw that with some of the pre-war stuff, right? That stuff kind of fell off a valuation cliff. But stuff like the homologation collection and some of those 80s, 90s eras cars are really skyrocketing right now.
I totally agree with you. And there are some outliers. There's a couple of cars I'll pull out from yesterday that surprised me because of that exact reason you just said.
Yep.
So basically, you know, baby boomers, stuff that's, they're selling their collections.
Yeah.
What they loved was from the 50s and 60s.
Right.
So basically, you know,
muscle cars,
53
and
to caddies and 60, stuff. You know, whatever. Are a little soft right now. I think muscle cars are going to buck the trend.
Yeah.
A couple of reasons why is they're so iconic. They have more options.
Shelby's are. I mean, Shelby's the 65 Fastback is arguably the most one of the most iconic cars in history.
Yeah. And they've been used in popular culture from the time they were created until, you know, now still.
Right.
You see movies with people driving old muscle cars. You
and
see
me,
commercials,
well,
what have you, you know. They're still in the popular culture.
You know, there's a lot of, there's a big resto mod thing going on, right? Very usable.
Yeah.
Somewhat reliable.
It's before you get into the crappy plastics of the 70s and the more difficult stuff.
Yeah. I have a strong like and dislike for resto mods.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I think resto mods should be done in the vein of the period. So if you're going to hot rod a 65 Fastback, it should be with parts that could have feasibly been around in the 5 to 10 years surrounding 1965. So for example, this will embody both that theory for me, but also my emotional aspect of collecting. My Speedster that we were talking about downstairs.
Yep.
That car was hot rodded all with basically Porsche factory parts in the nearly surrounding eras of that car. So it's got an early 911 transmission. It's got early 911 rear suspension.
Right.
It's got disc brakes that you could have found on a later 911. Everything on that car is Porsche, so it doesn't feel like a Frankenstein. It feels like you took a Speedster and just turned the dial up a few notches. And that makes it more usable. I can get in it and drive it to Monterey and back. I can drive it down the 101 freeway and not be scared to death in traffic. I can use that car in a daily format in today's context, but it still feels like I'm driving a Speedster. When you take a car like a Fastback and you drop a Coyote engine in it and a modern 5-speed.
That's too much.
And, you know, Bluetooth this, carbon fiber that, it just doesn't feel right to me.
Can we bookmark this conversation and revisit when you're 50 and see if you feel the same way?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm just kidding with you because I agree with you.
Yeah.
But as I get older, I'm like, man, it would be nice to have AC. It would be nice to have an LS3 engine in there.
There's times where you definitely want air conditioning.
Changed. Yeah.
And there's times where an LS3 is applicable for sure. But that's kind of more daily driver.
Yeah.
I look at cars as a way to transport me into eras that I couldn't experience before.
Mm-hmm.
So when I, you know, when I want to go to work, I get into Tesla. And when I want to have an experience, I get in something old. And
totally
I don't
agree.
Want to feel like I'm experiencing 2020 in a 1965 format. I want to experience 1965 for 1965.
Totally.
Yeah.
And and the emotional aspect of it, like you said, similar to your President Ken and his car, cars, to me, always start with their pickup. And I always feel like the first trip in a car has to be special. Otherwise, the car doesn't stay with me.
Yep.
And For example, the Speedster downstairs. The first trip, we bought that car at auction 2 summers ago. It was restored by Rod Emery in 2007. When we bought it, we had it shipped where it was in San Francisco down to Rod. Rod went through it and just did it, you know, gave it a quick once over.
Yep.
We flew to LA and we got in it. And the first drive we took in that car was LA to Monterey.
Right.
Spent a week in Monterey and then drove all the way home.
Yeah.
That was an extremely memorable experience. My 964. I bought that car in LA. I had a shop in LA go through it. I flew to LA. I spent a week in it and I drove it back here.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some sort of ritualistic aspect of the trip home when you purchase a car that to me sets the tone for the relationship you have with the car.
Totally agree.
And that sort of memory standpoint, like the 190E that sold, that did extremely well. The Lancia, that did extremely well. These are 80s and 90s kind of era homologation poster cars that people have that emotional connection with.
Right.
They remember watching those cars race. They remember seeing them when they were over in Europe. They remember, you know, having them on a poster on their wall. And our generation loves those cars.
Yeah.
Because we didn't grow up with that 80s box flare, you know, just ridiculous big wing style, and we love it. So.
Yeah, so cool.
Yeah, and you're hitting on some of the trends I picked out from yesterday. One of them was the homologation cars. So if you look, our estimates were strong, because we realized, what those things are going. Sometimes, though, the estimates don't keep up with what is actually happening.
Right.
You know, like we'll do our best. You know, we might, you know, say, hey, that's going to sell 100 to 150, and it sold for 175, and it just shows to your point that generation is really loving those cars, going after those cars, and sometimes you can't keep up with what's happening in the marketplace. So, like you said, the Lancia, the estimate was $90,000 to $110,000, and it sold for $118,000.
Right.
The 190E Evo 2.
That was an awesome car.
It was $175,000 to $225,000.
Sold for $240,000.
Yeah.
That's big. I mean, that's big money for those cars, and you know, I think it deserves it. I think that it's great and it sucks at the same time because now they're, you know, moving out of the affordability range. But I think those cars are the next big thing. I really think that they are, you know, they when the buyer pool that's aging in starts to get more purchasing power, we're going to see those numbers double.
I agree. And like the BMW M3 Sport Evo, that estimate was 125 to 150 and it sold for 190.
Yeah.
So all three of those cars.
I actually thought that estimate was low.
Yeah, you know, you got to really factor in the condition and the mileage.
Right. Yeah, that one had some more miles on it for sure. But, you know, I thought that would go past estimate, and it did. So that was good to see.
Yeah, and then another one I want everybody to keep an eye on for, I call it the future collectible, is
which one?
2011 Tesla Roadster.
Mm. Okay, so
yeah,
I have a bone to pick with that one.
What's up with that?
Tell me your bone you got to pick with that one.
Yeah, I want to hear.
I drive a Tesla. I don't think anything Tesla is collectible. And we had Steve Serio on the podcast last week, and we were talking about cars kind of post 2000 and collectibility versus speculation. And it's like a trinket to me. It's a point in time. It's a reference collectible.
Mm.
But I have a hard time thinking long term a Tesla is going to be a reference collectible unless it's like a 0 mile or a prototype or something, you know, very early in the production.
Yeah, I can see that.
To me, it's a used car.
So let me tell you why.
And it did a great number, as did the one in the past auction. People want them.
Which is interesting.
So I'd love to hear your perspective.
So at Elkhart, this is what blew me away. I think the estimate at Elkhart, now same car basically, but it only had like 3,000 miles on it.
Right. And it did like 125?
Yeah, and the estimate was 60 to 80.
Yeah.
It was insane. Now you got a couple of things working here. It's a industry disruptor, you know, it's
too sure.
It changed everything that's going on. Electric is here to stay.
Yeah, I agree.
It's first gen over 4 years. They only made about 2,400 of them.
Yeah,
so there's not a lot of them.
2,450 built between 2008 and 12.
And it's extremely low mileage. That one was an Elkhart.
Right.
Yeah.
So we learned our lesson from that one. You know, so this one had a lot more miles. I think this one had 14,000 miles, something like that.
Yep.
But we had the estimate 90 to 110, and it landed right in the middle.
Right.
So there this is an example of we were behind the trend at Elkhart. We're right on the trend at this one. So
yeah. I've never driven one. Are they fun?
I've never driven one either. I've never wanted to.
Are they a good time?
I remember going to the Santa Monica Airport and doing the Tesla test drives on with my dad. And then a friend of mine in high school who's always been ahead of the curve. And it's been fun to watch his trajectory. He just picked up a Zonda, actually. Pretty cool. He had one of the first Tesla Roadsters. And I'll never forget being at a house party in Santa Monica. And we had just got there. We pulled up, and he was pulling up in his Tesla Roadster. And he took me around the block in it. And here we are in, like, you know, the flats of Santa Monica, mm-hmm. total suburban, you know, house area.
Grid.
And, yeah, grid. And we're doing these ungodly accelerations and speeds in this neighborhood.
Right.
And no one was the wiser.
Right.
And it was the weirdest sensation to be doing that speed and that acceleration.
And you can do that
and you couldn't
silence.
Hear a thing.
It's the greatest car to drive like an asshole.
As a, yeah, exactly. As a,
it really is.
Yeah. I drive my Tesla like an asshole every day on the way to work because you fly under the radar. And
no one looks at you.
To me, it was a total industry disruptor.
Yeah.
But it's obsolete at this point for me. I mean,
yeah,
it's a great car, but, you know, and I'm jaded, right? But I think...
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
People collect weird things all the
fun.
Time.
It's cool looking, but...
It'll be interesting to see because you'll start seeing cars with 30,000 miles bring in more money than they should.
Right.
Mileage is less of a contender in the value these days, I feel like. People who really want a car, you know,
it's
they can
condition.
Overlook.
It's
more
about condition,
about originality.
Yeah, but I think the big numbers will come with the low mileage.
Yeah,
sure. As always.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and speaking of which, I just wanted to touch on the analog supercars because I actually have a podcast where I dive into the analog supercars. So when you're looking
favorite.
At those.
So 40, 50, you know.
We have the 550
all
to sell.
Murcielago.
The 550s, like the current GTs. I think those things are going.
Those are undervalued. We always say they're undervalued.
Yeah. I still think they're undervalued.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're approaching a million, and I still think they're undervalued.
It's like that 4 GT sold for, what, 925? Oh, no, that was a Senna. The 4 GT sold at this auction for how much? 825.
No, it was in the nines.
875.
875. And I turned to Eli, and I'm like, that or the nicest Carrera GT money could buy in black with no miles.
Right.
It's like, you know,
where you
it really
Carrera
depends
GTs
where
right
you're, where you're looking.
You know, they're on the upward trend. I'm trying to get that car into my collector car fantasy football, but I got $1 million salary cap. So
right. So that takes up
you
a
know,
big chunk.
Number three condition is like 340.
Mm-hmm.
Could I put it in there at number four condition so I could squeeze it in there? I don't
right.
know if I'm going to do that or
yeah.
not. Yeah. Because I really want that car in my fantasy football.
Yeah. Yeah. We all do.
In any fantasy, that car is the best.
Yeah. So we're going to do a special on analog supercars.
Cool.
And the two here that let me go with the one that wasn't as surprising. It was the 550 Barchetta,
mm-hmm.
the silver one, X-Rod Stewart, which I don't think that added really much to the actual valuation.
Yeah, you know.
That
it's
was
like
basic.
You want to have a car with someone else's assets at
right,
like,
right.
enjoy.
Gorgeous car. I love those cars. I'd love to
yeah,
have one
cool.
of those cars. It hit basically low estimate at 300, 295.
Nice color, too.
Yeah, silver and black. The one that really stood out was the 2000 Ferrari 550 Maranello.
That
red.
Sold
past
for
estimate.
A high number.
230.
Yeah, so the estimate was 150 to 200, which is right on.
Yep.
I was actually in Fort Lauderdale for Christmas, and the neighbor pulled up in a 550 with 6,000 miles on it.
Wow.
And I was like, let me see what that thing – it was a six-speed. And I said, let me see what that thing's worth. And it was right at 150,
right.
which is basically the same car out there. And that thing pulled in 230.
Because people are realizing that that car is really damn usable. In Ferrari senses, you know, it's somewhat reliable.
No, it's not.
550, yeah, it's not that bad.
We owned one.
But versus that, you own that or you own a Testarossa.
But okay.
I mean, you're going to be able to drive that thing every day. Testarossa, the engine out service, this and that. 550s aren't that unreliable.
Let me ask you, would you rather a gated shifter 550 or 575?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's a little bit more akin in price point.
Yep.
Or an 06 4 GT?
06 4 GT.
Why?
Probably that.
Just what they did to that car is so iconic. I mean, it looks like the car from the 60s.
Yep.
They did it so well.
Yeah.
You know,
it is really good looking.
You know, the V8 rear engine, 500, I think it's 550 horsepower.
Yeah.
It's just such a beast. It's got the, you know, the cutout doors. It's just such a cool, beautiful car. I think they're overpriced.
Really?
Well, no, let me rephrase that.
Yeah.
For the number produced,
okay.
kind of like Gullwings and,
right.
you know, 300 SLs. For the number to produce, they don't really necessarily warrant that high of a price, but they're
right.
getting it. And I honestly don't think it's going down.
Yeah, and to me...
I agree.
It's interesting that you say overpriced because I think it's underpriced from an experiential standpoint, right? Like, it's very hard to apply any real rationale to the numbers on cars because
who the hell thinks a McLaren F1 should be worth $20 million, right? Like, where do you put that market value on something? How do you practically, you know, from a practicality and any sort of logic standpoint, tell me a car is worth $20 million?
Right.
It's insane. So you just kind of have to look at it as relative scale rather than associate value to the dollar figure. Otherwise, the whole everything about what we do is insane and stupid and, you know, makes no sense. But from a relativity standpoint, if you look at the experience of a Ford GT and the experience of a Carrera GT, similar eras, analog, manual, last of its kind, pinnacle of the manufacturer, one had more produced than the other. But I would say if the Carrera GT is a 10 in terms of experience, the Ford GT is a 7.5 or an 8.
Did you ask me between a Carrera GT and a Ford GT?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood
Maranello
you.
And a
oh, no. Ford I was GT. Saying, I was saying, you know, before in the comparison, gotcha. Yeah, 550.
I would pick the Carrera GT in that case.
Yeah, for sure.
V10.
Yeah. But I'm saying,
but a Ford
to me,
GT and a Maranello.
The Carrera GT, on a relative standpoint to the Ford GT seems undervalued.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the interesting argument is do you want to spend $75 million for a Ferrari GTO?
Right.
Or do you want to spend $150 million for a Picasso?
Right. Neither.
That's the world we live in.
Buy the Picasso. You're not going to drive the GTO anyway. It's going to sit in your garage. You might as well buy the art, you know?
Some people race those.
Buy the sculpture.
Yeah.
I hope you buy it and race it. I hope you do.
Right.
Please.
I'll call it another trend. I don't know about a trend, but
sure.
That 98 roof.
Yeah,
993
Turbo R.
Porsche.
Yeah, don't get me started. I'm sour. I missed that one.
That thing went nuts. I mean, 525 to 575. I actually interviewed the owner a couple episodes ago.
Yeah.
Great guy.
Nice guy.
Immaculate car.
Yeah.
And it sold for $690.
I know. I wanted that car.
Is that surprising to you, that number?
No.
Because to me, and I
thought it
Eli
was fairly,
too, that sounds right.
I mean, it was a good estimate.
Yeah.
I think it just shows the rarity. I mean, there's only like 14 of those cars.
Right.
And four in all-wheel drive.
Right.
It's one of those ones where, like,
everyone wants a roof, too. It's another,
right.
It's another poster
roof,
car
and,
brand.
And it's one of those cars where you can apply the statement, go find another.
Mm-hmm.
You won't.
Right.
So what the price is whatever the two guys in the room are willing to pay for it.
I texted him congratulations
because
I thought it was about to end at like 600 and then it went up to like 690. I'm like, I actually texted that to you before.
Yeah, it was an early congratulations.
It was an early congratulations, so I should have put a couple more.
Now, the question here is, you know, I know the people who are buying these cars aren't thinking about it in this context, but what's, you know, a perfect 993 turbo going for these days?
Two-ish.
So you're spending
a little over two.
300K over
the mileage.
That.
I mean, I've seen them go for four.
400K over that.
200
miles. That's kind of like turbo-ass money there.
Yeah. I'm just looking at cars for the experience versus
the
value
and
the price. And is that car, and this is just me playing devil's advocate here, is that car really worth the $350,000 to $400,000 premium over the nicest turbo that you can maybe tweak, do a little things to? I don't know.
But,
I've driven both.
But
hey, the roof is great.
That's why money in the car world is so just irrational. It's like, is a McLaren F1
$19 million
more
than
a Carrera GT?
Right. Right.
In terms of experience.
Like, not really. No.
No. I mean, they're it's a big step.
Never
up.
Driven an F1.
But an extra $20 million? I don't think so.
Well, let me give you a car that you guys need to buy.
Which is?
Actually, I'll give you a couple cars. So
Subaru WRX STI.
Well,
yeah, give me stuff in the $15,000 bracket.
I believe that's one of the cars in my fantasy football.
I agree.
Okay. What year?
Like
the bug eye one?
Yeah.
That one's cool.
Yeah. So 930 Porsches.
Okay.
Non-turbo, turbo look.
Oh, so like the M491.
Right. Yeah, because, you know, people realizing, you know what, we don't like this turbo, this Widowmaker.
Right, we don't like that powertrain.
We don't like this, but we like the look, right?
Sure, sure,
so
yeah.
So you look at the values.
Flared arches.
Those are in the 80s.
Yeah, 87 to 89.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, so the 930 turbos are down like double digits.
Yeah.
Whereas the non-turbo look
3.2 turbo looks.
Yeah.
Like
30%. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because people are realizing, love the look, don't necessarily need the engine.
Okay, so that was my first Porsche I ever bought was a 930. And it was a miserable experience. I loved every second of it, but it was miserable.
Yeah,
it was like having a toxic relationship because I bought that car.
To be honest, I don't mind how 930s drive. Hello, Zara. We have a little German Shepherd over here. She hears 930 and she goes crazy.
She gets excited. German dogs, German cars. Well, no, so I bought a...
Yeah, and anyway, you like keep going.
I was working at Audi at the time. I bought the car off the used lot at Porsche Woodland Hills. Whatever I bought it for, I doubled that in maintenance costs in the first year. And then I sold it for break even. Mm-hmm. And then a year later, it was worth, you know, Zara, go away. Come here. We're having dog visitation here.
Will, I have to edit this part out.
And then a year later, it was, we'll leave that in. And then it was, a year later, it was worth half. Like those things went up and then down quickly. And I think exactly what you said, people love the look of the 930, the big arches. It looks fast, it looks aggressive, it's got that 80s style.
Yeah.
And then they drive it once and they go, what the hell is this? It's a horrible experience. Right. You stick your foot in the gas, you wait 3 seconds, rips your face off, then you crash. And
I think it's fun.
Yeah, but
if you know what you're doing,
the four-speed box is a novelty. It's fun, but then it gets annoying because you're never in the right gear.
I mean,
the car to have is, if you want a 930 and you want turbo power, it's the roof. It's the BTR, like the one we have here.
A 964
turbo. It's a 930 with a six-speed. It's a phenomenal experience.
It's so fun.
Yeah.
It's
otherwise,
car.
Throw them away.
We have a member who has a roof cabriolet based on a 930, roof stuck a six speed in it, and it just completely transforms the car. Obviously, it has upgraded brakes and suspension too. But
that goes right into what Greg's saying is people want the look of the turbo and the functionality of a non-turbo car.
And then there's weirdos like me who I don't want any look of the turbo, and I like the narrow body of the 3.2 Carrera with no wing, narrower tires, no grip. I've been dailying Eli's 78 SC, which, for no big difference in the body styling between that and a 3.2 Carrera.
Yep.
But the amount of fun you have just hustling that car down a road because it doesn't have the most grip, it doesn't have the most power, it's really a momentum car, and it just slides around as no downforce whatsoever. And it's just you and the car.
Well,
and that's
things.
It's
more fun to drive a slow car fast than 100%. It is a fast car slow.
I was about to say the same exact thing.
We've been saying,
I read your mind.
You know, people have been saying that forever, and it's true. It really is true.
Hypercars. They're great. They're awesome. We saw some strong numbers. We saw some medium numbers. But in any of those cars, by the time you move from first to second gear, you're going to jail.
Yep. You're going to your first
and actually, I was
going to
mention that. My take is the instant collectibles, so to speak. They're coming down.
Right. To me, that's jumbo shrimp.
That's jumbo shrimp, right. So before, you'd buy a Senna, and you know these guys would flip it and make $300,000-$400,000.
Yep.
You know, the Ford GTs are making $600,000.
Yep. Right.
So all those numbers are down to $50,000 to $100,000 or even slight loss.
Right.
Right? So to me, that's good because I don't want the speculators.
I agree.
If you have a Ford GT lightweight with 8 miles, that's a shame, right?
I agree.
And I would drive the wheels off of those cars.
Oh, yeah.
You know? So that's one of the other takeaways I saw from yesterday. And it's just supply and demand. You know, when Ford GTs were not available, they were $600,000 over sticker.
Yeah.
You know? So
you had to write a book to get one.
Right. Right.
It is one of the best, I think, of the supercar row down there. And we're sitting here looking out.
It's really good. It's a great looking
car. A Ford GT, an Enzo, a Koenigsegg, a Senna, a Speedtail. Of those cars, I think the best looking is the Ford GT, and it's the lowest price point.
Yeah.
Before the I fell in love with that Speedtail. I didn't think I would.
Really?
I don't like the front wheels, obviously. Those are kind of weird.
Yeah, man.
But, man, that thing is insane. I mean, and the Koenigsegg is pretty cool. I think it looks better from the back than it does the front.
Right. People say that about me, too.
The flying buttresses of the Ford GT in the back, the rear view, I just think it's one of the prettiest cars ever built.
I think
it's very purposeful looking, too.
I think if you compare the Koenigsegg to the Pagani, which is about the closest you can get, I think the Koenigsegg, to me, is more aggressive. Like, I look at the Koenigsegg, and it looks like a fighter jet.
Yeah.
And I think it's the coolest car out there.
Like, Koenigsegg is pure. It's a much purer design. It's just smooth surfaces. The Pagani is... That's like how... When I look at it, I just see too much this, that, angles. The Koenigsegg is just...
It's elegant. Whereas the Pagani, though,
is... like a wind.
Like, if you think of like a... Think of like a modern home.
Yeah.
Right? It looks futuristic, but sexy and stylish at the same time. To me, that's the Koenigsegg.
Yeah.
The Pagani is like an Italian mansion. Like,
opulent.
It is opulence. There's tons of detail work. On every wall, there might be a hand-painted, what's it called? Mural.
Yeah, a little something-something.
And that's the Pagani. Like, the door latches are machined aluminum. Right. There's not a single detail on that Pagani that was mass production or missed in terms of attention to detail.
True.
But for half the price to have a Koenigsegg that looks more aggressive, drives more aggressive, and to me is a cooler car, you know, again, it's relativity. $2.5 million versus $5 million.
Right.
But I think from a money aside standpoint, I'd take the Koenigsegg out of that row all day long. What's the thing, you know?
I agree.
Burn, keep, or?
Keep, cash, and crush?
Yeah.
Wait, what is it?
Keep, cash,
that's
and
my,
crush.
That's mine for my keep, podcast. Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. Keep,
and cash, crush. And crush.
That's a good one.
You'll be playing that on my podcast,
I would keep the Koenigsegg. I would cash the 4GT, and I would crush the Speedtail.
Well, let me get new cars for your interview. Cash, no, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
So if those are so what kind of house is the Senna?
What kind of house is the Senna?
like the Senna? Iron Man's lair or something.
No.
Senna is functional. Like,
yeah.
Nothing.
It is functional.
It but it hurts good my point. Eyes. It's
yes.
So ugly. It hurts my
the
eyes.
The Senna is a bomb shelter.
It's like a brutalist, factory or something, which is concrete, you know, big, just needs to produce a lot of whatever they're producing, and it's all
like
function.
I'm looking at one of those posters that's all blurry, and you have to cross your eyes. To
Right.
Like a bit of a Rorschach.
Or have you ever seen one of those posters? They take like every photo of like, let's say, the presidents or something, and they like
turn
make them really,
one.
Really tiny, and like then it becomes one photo of like Bill Clinton or something, and you're just like, what the hell's going on there? Like his eyes, someone else, and it's
a car.
It's like
maybe I should
like
cross
that.
My eyes when I'm looking at a Senna. Though.
It's and it's an in-between car, right? I always look at cars for their uses.
Yeah,
cars have moods. Cars have uses. The 4GT is very usable.
Yeah,
the Koenigsegg is like, it's the day you put on your gold watch. You want to get in the Koenigsegg. Yeah. You know, it's that kind of like over the top. Everybody look at me because you're not using all that on the road.
No,
and the Senna to me, the problem with it is there's no use. Right? It's too much for the road, and it's almost too much for the track because you don't want to track a million-dollar car that's not a race car.
Right, right.
You start wearing out the components on that thing, and it gets really expensive really quickly.
Right. So guess what? A 720S with sticky tires will do almost the same lap times, and then you get to drive it every day on the street.
So what do you do?
And,
what do you
have
do
a great, great car. What do you do with a Senna? I don't know. Don't ask me.
I don't know. Anyway.
They're incredible.
I don't know.
They're
cool,
the
though.
Technological... You know, amazing stuff going on there. All right, let me call out two more things real quick.
Yeah.
Well, three more things. Actually, four. So the deal of the day, believe it or not, I think was our highest sale, that Jaguar D-Type.
Oh, yeah.
I agree.
I mean, that is – it's rare that you see a car with such pedigree. Mm-hmm. It's so beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I love the
racing
red.
History.
The red's cool.
And it's one of those cars that's right, and it's no stories – it's investment grade, you know. So the person that bought that for
five-ish,
it was $5.45 million.
Mm-hmm.
I think the estimate was 5 to 7.
That's almost as much experience as a GTO to me.
Right. Oh yeah.
Right.
Sure.
So $5 million versus 40 to 70.
Oh, yeah. And it's a Le Mans race car. Like it's
actually I'm actually working on a future podcast. What is it going to be? Same performance, half the price.
Yeah.
Okay.
So kind of like a Jaguar versus a Aston Martin of the same year.
Yeah. 458 versus a C8 Corvette.
Right. Right. Yeah. So, you know, even it might even have the same, you know, engine technology, double overhead cam or whatever, same era. But because maybe it's not as pretty, maybe it's not, you know, whatever.
The brand doesn't have
so
the objectivity or whatever.
Right. If you want to experience the same thing for half the price, I mean, to your point, you know, there's cars that, you know, GTOs, $70 million now.
Right.
Cars of the same era that probably actually outperformed and actually had disc brakes.
Right.
You know, that maybe even technologically were more advanced.
Right.
Are selling for $5 million.
Yeah.
Right. I'm going to do that in the future just because I think that's pretty fascinating.
I think that's a good idea.
That. So, all right, let me go on. This is the last bit here. These are the cars that my biggest surprises of this auction.
Yeah, let's go.
All right. Let's see. All of them were four seaters.
Okay.
Interesting.
Two of them had four doors.
Okay.
So think of the last time.
The 190E is on there?
It is not.
Really?
So think of the last time.
Was it the wagon? The S-Class wagon?
Maybe.
That sold for a lot of money.
Yeah. Think of the last time the words four-door, you know, were used to say I was surprised by the results at an auction on these cars.
I mean,
because those are undervalued. I mean, a 57 Chevy four-door is worth a third of what the two-door is, right?
Okay, so I get where you're going now. So let me do a little predictability. It's the wagon that was estimated at 30 to 40 that sold for $100,000.
Correct.
Nuts.
It's the Cadillac Eldorado that blew
that
past estimate.
Sold for a lot of money. That blue one
set
on there.
What year Eldorado?
The blue one with the stainless roof.
61.
Okay.
Good.
And then what other four doors were there? The Lancia.
No, there's only two four doors in this.
Oh,
list.
There's only two four doors.
The last one's two doors.
And the last one.
A little hint. You already mentioned it earlier.
Two door car.
Which one had they had to pull all the specialists from the floor to...
Is that the Rolls-Royce?
The Rolls-Royce.
Mm. Yeah.
So what is fascinating about this
What's the fourth one?
No, no, those are the three.
Oh, three. Okay.
The fourth one was the Jag I mentioned.
Got it.
So what's fascinating is, you know, what we talked about, generational shift.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the 57 Cadillac just blew by blew by the estimates. 80 to 120 grand was the estimate. Sold for 165.
That was crazy.
And that car actually was, high. I think it was a no sale at our Auburn.
Hey, Zara, go away.
It's very interesting.
Zara, go.
Different markets. These are beautiful German Shepherds.
Yeah, they get really, you know, when we sit here and talk for 30, 40 minutes without them, they feel very left out.
They're like, play with me.
Yeah, they want to be in the podcast.
So that Brougham, that's a four-door, but it's the suicide doors, which is insane and super cool, and stainless steel roof.
Yeah, I thought that roof was the coolest thing ever.
Yeah, so that thing, I knew that was going to sell well because we have these meetings prior to the auction to see, gauge the level of interest. And that one had a lot of interest from, you know, online phone bidders.
Yeah.
And then when, you know, we had crowds around that Rolls-Royce.
Yeah, that was insane.
And when you see, if you ever watch one of our auctions and you see the car specialist main in the phone desk, when they stand up, it means they have an active bidder.
Right. Right.
So when that car came up,
everybody stood up.
They pulled two of us from bid spotting because they didn't have enough people behind the desk.
They had more phone bids coming in, excuse me.
Right. Yeah. So we had like 15 of us standing up for that car.
That was
It was so funny because I was given this guy's number to call, and I called him like three times. He never answered. So I'm like, call me if you want to bid on this car right now.
Yeah.
But, you know,
did he call back?
It was insane. So you got two four doors. They all have four seaters. None of these are sports cars, and yet they blew by the estimates. Now the Mercedes, the 1990 Mercedes wagon you mentioned, that's just kind of insane.
Yeah, I don't know why that one did so much money. I mean, the coach built aspect of it is cool, but
kind
to
of
me,
one of a kind, and it's
it is
looks it's, good
it's
condition.
One of a kind, but if I was buying it, I wouldn't want the coach built example. It feels almost too delicate.
And why not?
Is it engineered by the factory? And I don't know. There's something weird about it.
No, but the reason why it's so valuable is because it was coach built because they didn't make the S-Class wagon.
But the gas tank was behind the rear seats because they extended the chassis. Mm-hmm. They had nowhere to put the gas tank, so now the rear seats don't fold down.
Yeah.
So the wagon aspect of it is null.
So that's actually
a good point.
Exact opposite situation of the Rolls-Royce. So the Rolls-Royce, we had like 15, 20 people bidding on the car.
Right.
The wagon, it came down to two guys that just had to have that car.
Yeah.
And we got into a bidding contest with two guys.
People are niche freaks. They want like the most, you know,
takes two to
subtle,
tango.
Low production, coach built, and in this case, station wagons, estates, Avants, whatever you call them.
Yeah.
And they'll bid, you know, there's a bidding war on that.
Yeah.
Two people, like you said.
Do
it's
we
nuts.
Have
100 grand for that car? It's crazy.
Do we have
but I like that car.
The we'll see if it shows statistics up at on sell through and gross sales yet?
Unofficial.
Okay.
This is my own math.
Yeah.
But I know it's going to be pretty close.
Please.
The official should come out here shortly. It's about an 88% sell-through rate, which is bigger than last year.
Yeah.
Higher than last year. Let's see. The actual dollar amount was about 10% more than last year.
With less cars.
With less cars.
Yeah.
You know, so people ask, well, how is the industry doing in COVID?
I think that comes down to the venue.
Venue was very cool for sure. I think we have this massive transition to folks being more comfortable with buying online.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think RM Sotheby's does a tremendous job because, unlike some of the other online companies out there, you have somebody you can call.
Right.
That will, well, first off, you have a condition report, you have 150 pictures.
All right.
You know, it's very detailed. So you have comfort when you bid on this car that you know what it's all about.
Right.
I mean, I was on the phone with clients. You know, FaceTiming, you know, show me the underside, you know.
There's another level of transparency and personal experience.
Which you have to have.
Yeah,
if
I
you
agree.
Want to,
at these dollar numbers, for sure.
At these dollar numbers, exactly. So, I mean, I was trying to take a note of when the car sold online versus live and in person, you know. And, I mean, we have
that'll be an interesting statistic.
Right.
To see. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we have the record for the highest price ever paid for an online car, which is, I think, $4.1 million for the 550 Pro Drive Maranello.
Right. That was a cool
Ferrari.
Car. Do you remember
Street
that one?
Car,
I think I saw that car running at the Historics in Monterey 2 years ago, maybe.
I mean, it was just the most iconic.
That car was in the Northeast for a bit.
Yeah.
Was that in the Northeast of the United States for a bit?
It was a really cool car.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I
anyway, had we want to jump on your podcast, so should we do a little transition?
Sure.
Yeah, sure.
Awesome. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to our post-auction recap.
Post-auction spiel.
Yeah, our post-auction spiel on Fuel.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for coming.
Greg.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. And I'm going to take a quick bathroom break, and we're going to jump on Greg's podcast.
All righty.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Fuel for Thought. To listen to even more great stories from our special guests, make sure to subscribe to FFT on Apple Podcast and Spotify. My name is Sam Bierenbaum, and on the behalf of Auto Car Club and my co-host Eli Kogan, we wish you a great rest of your day. And don't forget, no matter where you are, take some time, grab your keys, and go for a drive.